You're listening to The Takeaway Podcast. Check out our website at thetakeaway.org. You'll find other interesting stories, quizzes, and behind-the-scenes photos and videos.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. And I wonder how many times you have been told to follow your passions, do what you love. That's the key to, what is it, the key to doing, actually, following what you love. Oprah says you do what you love. How is that different from being able to do whatever you want? Oprah can kind of do whatever she wants. What is the value of pep talks from billionaire legends like Steve Jobs and Oprah, lions of the motivational business? Am I doing what I love? If so, who cares? And if so, is this something I can take credit for, or have I been lucky, taking advantage of lots of opportunities, blasting through some earlier misery to be prepared to do what I'm doing now? You know, I have no idea, and I don't think about it that much. I generally think that the do what you love movement might not apply to everyone. I want to be a proctologist nurse or repair rain gutters, kill bed bugs. Do these avocations have lovers? Do you start from a place of gutter repair love and go for your dreams? Or maybe it's more like you're doing it and after a while you get really good at it and that becomes your passion and then you love it. From Royal Oak, Michigan, one of you has this brilliant insight. I wanted to be an architect, but I've been turned off by the costs, the amount of time to become a professional, and the major adjustment I would have to make in my life, no prior training or experience. Well, you've learned there, Royal Oak. It's just not worth it. I get it. Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE, and we'll talk more about doing what you love, or not, later this hour. And we'll also have a look at the musical soundtracks that coach you through those video games. Where do themes like Super Mario Brothers come from? We'll find out about that. But we begin at the end of the last episode of the saga we're going to call Clinton Abbey.
I am very proud to have been Secretary of State. But I leave this department confident. Confident about the direction we have set.
That's Hillary Clinton saying goodbye to her colleagues at the State Department after a stint that at the very least separated her from the failed presidential campaign and cleared the deck for a possible run for the presidency in 2016. Among those betting she will is the largest liberal super PAC, Priorities USA Action, already starting to raise money. But for a woman who has been in the White House before and has a list of allies that would fill a stadium, or six, the Clintons have a unique problem, managing the players while keeping a tight team in control that can anticipate the issues and tactics of 2016 and not stumble on the memories and consequences of things that happened way back in 1998 or in 2008. Amy Chozick is a national political reporter for our partner, The New York Times, who covers Hillary Clinton. She has the cover story in this weekend's New York Times magazine about the former Secretary of State. Amy, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thanks. Thanks for having me.
So you're beginning, it would seem, a fairly long journey here between now and the election, depending on the various decisions that need to be made by Hillary Clinton. Yes?
Yes, that's right.
And would you say that the Clintons have learned lessons from campaigns of the past, particularly 2008?
I think something you hear from particularly Hillary Clinton's people over and over again is that the State Department was run nothing like her chaotic 2008 campaign. It's something they kind of consistently want to remind reporters. And I think that's important because it tells, you know, it sends the message that she won't have the same managerial mishigas that sort of hurt her 2008 campaign.
So they definitely view her last episode as being Secretary of State, nothing to do with the 2008 campaign. That's ancient history. At least they want it to feel that way.
Exactly. They want it to feel that way. But one thing that she learned about state that I touch on in the story is that, you know, during the campaign, there were a lot of cooks in the kitchen. The Clintons have been collecting friends, advisors, people who feel invested in her future for 40 years. And when she was at state, she was very cloistered off. And so she only had a tight-knit group of advisors around her. She was able to keep the noise out. And so I think now the question is, could she apply that to another campaign?
And that's really the question. It's a design question of how do you create a bubble without inviting in or alienating all of those people who have been loyal for 40 years? How are they doing that?
Exactly. I mean, I think it's something that they have to figure out. I mean, someone close to the Clintons said we've already discussed maybe having some kind of chief listener, you know, someone who makes these well-meaning loyalists feel heard, and some of their ideas will be great. But ultimately, a 2016 campaign is going to be run by 20 and 30-somethings who know how to manage data and all the kind of modern ways that presidential campaigns are waged. And so who can listen to those people, incorporate some of their ideas, but not let it become this complete, you know, just noisy battle?
And you suggest that there's an initiative already underway that some of the old guard Clinton loyalists are fairly suspicious of as kind of a make-work deal, a sort of sandbox for them to play in while the real work goes on by the 20-somethings.
Right. I mean, we're already seeing a couple super PACs emerge that have, you know, separate from what Secretary Clinton is doing, are sort of gearing up. And that's Ready for Hillary and that's Priorities USA. And those two have kind of sort of clashed. Priorities has said Ready for Hillary is a make work program for old Clinton loyalists. But then, you know, recently a lot of old Clinton loyalists have joined the board of Priorities. So there are already turf battles happening.
As you see these turf battles beginning, what's really going on here?
I think everybody is worried about their place in the world. I mean, one source drew a triangle for me on a cocktail napkin when I met him for coffee and said, the triangle is the Obama hierarchy. You know that the Obamas are on top. You know where you fall if you work for them. And the Clintons are very inclusive people. It's a circle. He drew a circle for the Clintons and he said, you know, that's great. It makes people feel very loved and part of the Clinton family, but it also creates a lot of not knowing where you stand. So I think it's an organizational issue that comes with the Clintons' style of embracing staff and aides and friends and collecting people. I mean, literally since Bill Clinton's kindergarten class.
Considering this notion of people who don't know where they stand, is it clear what role Bill Clinton will have in this campaign?
I think that's a good question. That was a big question in 2008. How do we utilize the former president? Obviously, he's our strongest surrogate, enormously popular. And that will be a question again, I'm sure.
And what about the role?
If there is a campaign.
Right, if there is a campaign. And what about the role of Chelsea? How has she emerged as a real player here?
Well, I think this is interesting. I mean, Chelsea has taken a real ownership role over the family's philanthropy and charitable work at their foundation. And the question is, would she also have sort of a leadership role in some kind of political campaign? I mean, right now, her aides and Secretary Clinton's aides say she is not involved in her mother's schedule or her mother's, you know, any kind of planning in her personal office. But she is a major presence in their lives now because she's taken over the family foundation.
How much of a personal stake, or is there any way to know at this point, does Hillary have in doing this right, in making whatever decision she makes as a real sort of legacy moment for what has been a career of public service?
I think it's absolutely vital, and you can't even look at it just for her legacy, but his own legacy. You know, another loss, what would that do to their philanthropic work? What would that do to his legacy? I think it's crucial right now that they try to figure out whether they can answer these questions.
Who's closest to them right now on that question of are they going to run? What is the legacy question? When do they step up?
Yeah, what's fascinating about Hillary is that she has developed a tight-knit group of aides who a lot of them worked with her in the White House. Some of them are not on her payroll now, but they talk to her all the time, and those include Cheryl Mills and Maggie Williams and Capricia Marshall, who was with her at the State Department, Huma Abedin, obviously. And these women all go back to Hillary land in the White House. So it's a long time that they've been together, and I think that they, you know, whether they think their boss should run or not, they are definitely invested in her doing what's right for herself and her legacy.
The folks closest to Hillary Clinton at the State Department were referred to by some as the Royal Council, I believe.
Well, one aide described them as the Royal Council, but I think I would put those longtime aides who were with her in the White House in that category. And then there's, you know, people like Philippe Reins, who is her kind of principal gatekeeper, who I write about in the piece. He would also be in there. And, you know, she has brought in new people.
Do the Clintons have a sense that the New York Times is sort of part of the Clinton message transferring machine, that the Times is sympathetic to the Clintons, is out to get the Clintons? It's going to be a sort of tough road to hoe in your journey with Hillary Clinton over the next year or so?
Well, it's a complicated question. I think that increased scrutiny, any candidate or potential candidate would not necessarily view that as, you know, a positive thing, especially particularly right now. Secretary Clinton sort of just wants to deliver her paid speeches and float under the radar. I mean, the second that she is viewed as a politician, she becomes much more polarizing. So I think there is a sensitivity to any kind of media scrutiny. I mean, that being said, you know, they do want to draw attention to some of her speeches about income inequality and universal pre-K and issues that she's been talking about.
And has anyone uttered the words vast right-wing conspiracy to date?
You know, you'd be surprised how many words come up, Whitewater, vast right-wing conspiracy, you know, impeachment, that were just decades ago, but those still come up.
Well, it's a part of why there's so much at stake in this campaign, because it's really an enormous chapter of U.S. history that's going to be played out.
Absolutely. And they're unlike any other political family. I mean, it's really fascinating.
Amy Chozick is national political reporter for our partner, The New York Times, covering Hillary Clinton. She has the cover story in this weekend's New York Times magazine. Congratulations, Amy. Thanks so much.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
The state of the union.
The state of our union.
State of the union.
My fellow Americans, the state of our union is
going to be fine.
Very, very public.
A complete disaster.
A little more honest.
Business as usual.
As you may have gathered there, the next big event in Barack Obama's life happens next Tuesday, where he has a chance to set up some of the issues that will dominate the off-year elections in 2014 and give a glimpse of what might be ahead for 2016. State of the Union speech number 6 from Barack Obama will be delivered on Tuesday. These ceremonial affairs have regular Americans in the audience who get pointed to, folks in uniform who get standing ovations, and all of those promises. We will do this. We must do that. What should be on Obama's to-do list in advance of the State of the Union? We're putting together a takeaway to-do list, calling it SOTU to do. And we need your help. Tweet us at the takeaway. Use the hashtag SOTU-to-do. That's hashtag SOTUTODO. And we'll make our own listener-sponsored to-do list for the president, which he will follow to the letter, I guarantee you. For more on what we're likely to hear on Tuesday and what the president might not address, we turn to Takeaway Washington correspondent Todd Zwillick. Todd, go for it.
Hi, John. Well, you know, we can definitely predict, if you want to use that word, a couple of things that will be in the speech. Now, the White House has not done any of their traditional State of the Union leaking, which they like to do a couple of, you know, 48 to 24 hours before the speech. But I do know from a couple from Hill aides who are briefed on these things and actually help the White House craft the message, we know a couple themes that are going to be in there. Income inequality, you can bet on it. There will be a number of initiatives and themes from the president, and we can already guess from the Capitol Hill agenda a couple things that are going to be on there. Unemployment insurance extension remains unpassed. The president will talk about that because Congress hasn't reached an agreement for about 1.6 million people who had their benefits expire. Minimum wage increase nationally will definitely be on the list. So will making college more affordable. So will early childhood education and income inequality in general. The president will talk about how the economy is recovering, but is leaving way too many people behind. Of course, we saw reports yesterday that what was it, the 85 richest people in the world have the same wealth as 3.5 billion. Now that's globally, but that's the same kind of theme that the president's going to address without a doubt. John Hill mentioned immigration for sure, because the Congress has failed to pass comprehensive immigration reform, and the president knows that the pressure is on Republicans to try to come up with an answer to the bipartisan bill that the Senate passed, and that's important. Sort of important for 2014, but vital for 2016. And you may see a nod towards climate change, John, although nobody really expects Congress to pass anything substantial on that this year.
Todd Zwillick, Takeaway Washington correspondent, thanks so much.
You bet.
Climate change is being mentioned all day today at the Davos Forum of Billionaires and Bigwigs. Later, Coral Davenport from The New York Times on how anticipating climate change is becoming part of the business plans of some very big companies. That's coming up here on The Takeaway.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International in collaboration with The New York Times and WGBH Boston Public Radio.
Here's a movie classic from a long time ago.
Mulray didn't want to build a dam, and he found out you were dumping water at night. Then he was drowned.
Mr. Giddes, that's an outrageous accusation.
Dumping thousands of gallons of water down the toilet in the middle of a drought, that's news.
The drought-parched mysteries lurking in the water politics of Los Angeles in the movie Chinatown. Who gets water? In California, that has always been a theme of politicians, where the placement of a dam determines whether one town becomes a golf paradise while another town remains a desert. All the old and new themes of water politics in California have emerged in 2013, the driest year on record in the state, and the Colorado River-dependent city of San Diego has seen just 2.2 inches of rain since last July, less than half the normal average. Facing this emergency crisis is an interim mayor, Todd Gloria, who took over from Bob Filner, who resigned after a scandal last August. And this interim mayor is caught in a very real drama that has pitted town against town and region against region.
This is very difficult for the entire state. You have other communities that are vying for a very limited resource. We've tried to handle this in San Diego by making really substantial investments in our reservoirs to increase overall supply and then to diversify our water portfolio. So you see us making incredible investments in desalinization, water reuse, and, of course, in conservation. And San Diegans have responded to that conservation message by dramatically reducing their actual individual usage of water. All of these are strategies that are going to make it so that we can get through this drought, I think, perhaps better than the rest of the state.
Is the 20% voluntary water reduction, you know, suggested by Governor Brown? It's not mandatory. It's basically an urging. Is that enough? Should that have been mandatory? Are you satisfied with the 20% number there?
Well, here in San Diego, we have received voluntary compliance from our consumers. They've reduced their water usage by over 15%. And again, that's why our picture looks a little bit better than the rest of the state. I can't speak to what other jurisdictions are dealing with. I don't know that they've made the same sort of level of investments in infrastructure and the like. What concerns me most, John, is that for these folks who have made radical reductions in the usage of water, they still see their water bills going up. And that's a reflection of the fact that this is a very scarce commodity, much like the gas that you and I may put into our cars, and unfortunately doesn't really match the conservation effort. So a typical complaint I receive at a town hall meeting is, I've done all this stuff to conserve, and yet my bill still goes up. But I think this is really the new normal for the state of California.
Given that level of anger and the kinds of things that you're already seeing at city council meetings, do you think Governor Brown is an appropriate, reassuring leader in a crisis like this? How about your mayoral candidates? Do they both have the potential to reassure? And what about yourself? Have you been drawn into this as an interim mayor and have had to do some of that work on your own?
Yeah, well, I have incredible confidence in Governor Brown. I mean, obviously, he's a pro. He's lived through this before, and I think his leadership on this issue is actually quite good. He's certainly not one to deal with a lot of happy talk. Ultimately, we're trying to position ourselves to make sure that people conserve as much as possible, that the city itself is diversifying our portfolio. In the 1990s, we were incredibly reliant solely on Colorado River water and some from the California Aqueduct. Now, through conservation and other efforts here locally, we're in a better position. But I expect this problem only to get worse with time as, you know, populations grow, not just in California, but upstream. And so it was just a lot of work for myself and for future mayors of the city.
Does this resurrect statewide issues like the peripheral canal and water projects that, you know, were huge, involved regions, not just states? May get a new look?
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. You know, the governor has talked about a substantial investment in water through a water bond, perhaps for the voters' consideration soon. I think that resurrects that. Additionally, I think it makes all of us have to look at what we're doing internally. You know, we spend a lot of money on lots of different public services, but naturally, water is just a base need, and it does touch every sort of corner of our lives. Interestingly, when we had more significant water restrictions a few years ago, in the city and the mayor at that time really called on folks to quit watering their lawns, et cetera. What was interesting was the public's reaction, where folks really embraced that. It kind of became a keeping up with the neighbor's situation where, you know, how brown can my lawn get compared to the other guy? And, that's a part of why we're in a more favorable position currently, because people have kind of held on to that and have not just had brown lawns, but sort of started adjusting toward more drought tolerant and water resilient planting. So you would see it in a lot of different ways if you were to come to San Diego.
He's the interim mayor of the city of San Diego in California in the middle of that state's drought emergency. Todd Gloria, thanks so much.
John, thank you.
We talked this week about new research that identified a crucial turning point in the development of our memories. By age 7, childhood amnesia in the brain begins to take effect, so our memories are forgotten at a faster rate. And sometimes we lose whole periods of our childhood entirely. But those first memories, as you're telling us, the brain holds on to those.
Hi, my name is Erica. I'm calling from Round Rock, Texas. My earliest memory is sitting in a stroller as my dad points out the moon, which was full that night, and is singing a rhyme. I was maybe about 2 years old.
Heather in Louisville. I was almost 3 years old, she writes. We were moving to a new house across town. While still at the old house, I remember my bed sitting on the very large pickup truck. I can still remember the details of that moment, the sky, the truck, the temperature of the air, Oklahoma City, this Alexander Bailey. Fourth birthday, 1984. I remember not knowing most of the kids who were there, but I also remember that I got a plastic two-headed dragon and a He-Man power sword. The sword got destroyed in a backyard battle sometime later, but I still have that dragon, and those presents were just the beginning of what has become a lifelong love of Dungeons and Dragons.
Hey, my name is Chris Heilman. I grew up in Hershey, Pennsylvania. My earliest memory is smelling chocolate. It was fantastic, and to this day, there's certain things that remind me of when I was younger. Hey, thanks.
Mary in Reston, Virginia. My earliest memory is sitting in the middle of the movie theater in my hometown watching the scene from E.T. where he hides in Gertie's stuffed animals.
Elliot.
I taught him how to talk now. He can talk now.
Elliot.
I was two when the movie came out, and to this day, I tell everyone it's one of the reasons I became a filmmaker, because I remember how powerful and wonderful that specific memory was. Our number for sharing your earliest memory is 877-8-MY-TAKE. Share your story at facebook.com/thetakeaway. We love to hear from you. This is The Takeaway.
The northern sky is a beautiful thing, McIntosh.
None of you will get my kingdom. I leave you nothing, and I wish you plague.
Leon, I want you to teach me how to be like you.
Oh, stewardess, I speak jive.
It's Movie Friday, and with us, Rafer Guzman, film critic for Newsday, Kristen Meinzer, culture producer for The Takeaway. Together, they make up the Movie Date Podcast, which you can find at moviedatepodcast.org. Welcome.
Hi, John.
So we've got a monster. We've got a monster this week, right?
Oh, that's right. Boy, do we ever.
Monster Mash.
And do we really need another Frankenstein? This weekend's release is I, Frankenstein. Tell me a little bit about it.
Well, this is, again, the superhero version of Frankenstein. Of course, it's Frankenstein's monster. He's been created, and he finds himself now, 200 years later, in the midst of a clash between two warring immortal clans, and he must help save mankind.
And the original Frankenstein was just sort of cobbled together, very much in need of repair, electrically driven something or other. This Frankenstein is much better engineered, Kristen.
You cannot kill him. You can try. And what it comes down to is you don't realize that he has a soul, and that's his real power, is that he has a soul.
Here's a clip from I, Frankenstein.
Nibirius has found a way to summon every demon you've ever descended.
What?
Possession. In bodies that have no souls.
Only the dead have no souls. What is the use of possessing a corpse?
There is none. Unless you can animate that corpse.
Does this rely on the source material at all, or is this completely something new?
It starts off with him being created by Dr. Frankenstein, and that is about 30 seconds into the movie, and then it completely just goes off on some other world. I can't even explain what's happening in this movie half the time. It's so preposterous. It's so far-fetched. Just the one line I remember from the movie is Aaron Eckhart as the Frankenstein monster saying, "I'm not a man. I'm not a gargoyle. I'm not a demon." And that's pretty much the whole movie.
Anything profound here? I mean, the Frankenstein allegory in the original novel was this is the Prometheus story, the giving of fire to humanity.
It is kind of interesting hearing Queen Lenore, who is the gargoyle queen, say that Frankenstein's manual, the way that he constructed Frankenstein, is the proof that God is no longer the sole creator of man. And that's kind of a profound moment.
The only profound moment.
So it doesn't save the movie?
You know, I actually kind of liked it. Kind of a really good performances from Aaron Eckhart and also Bill Nye, the great Bill Nye as Nibirius. You know, you've got these committed performances like that in a junky movie like this, it really kind of saves it to me.
I'm absolutely shocked, Rafer. I am absolutely shocked.
I knew you would be.
I really thought this was one of the worst movies so far this year. Just terrible.
All right. Well, you're looking forward to Sundance, both of you, because that's kind of your thing, your sort of indie kind of impulse.
That's totally my bag. Yeah.
All right. So you both have picks for what is going to come out of Sundance. We don't know exactly how it will come out of Sundance. Rafer, why don't you begin?
One of mine is Calvary, which is reunites Brendan Gleeson with Martin McDonagh. They did a film together called The Guard, which I thought was just a wonderful black comedy. He played a cop in that film. Here he plays a priest in Ireland.
Little clip from Calvary.
What do you want to say to me?
I'm here to listen to whatever you have to say.
I'm going to kill you, Father.
Certainly a startling opening line.
And for you, a musical pick.
Oh, and as you know, I love musicals. And this musical is by Belle and Sebastian's lead singer, Stuart Murdoch. It's called God Help the Girl. It's the story of a boy and a girl and a girl. And it is during those wonderful, wistful years between coming of age and not quite living your career and having your dreams fulfilled yet.
We'll go out on a song from that film, Perfection as a Hipster, from God Help the Girl. On the podcast this week,
we're going to be talking more about Sundance with somebody on the ground there who's going to help us through the big picks and possibly some not such great movies.
Or it might be colder there than it is here. Rafa Guzman, film critic for Newsday. Kristen Meinzer, culture producer for The Takeaway. Together they are the Movie Date Podcast. Thanks, guys.
Thanks, John.
When ideology smashes into reality, reality usually wins, have you noticed? And that may be the story as some major corporations are beginning to orient their business strategies toward an expectation of climate instability, making assumptions that severe weather is becoming part of the climate, and making investments to minimize disruptions as a matter of good business. Coral Davenport, energy and environment reporter for our partner, the New York Times, has been looking into how environmental awareness has been creeping into some pretty big bottom lines. Carol, welcome back to The Takeaway.
Good to be here, John.
So explain to me how it's becoming a sort of business reality of companies to factor in climate insecurity, if not climate change, into their business models and revenue projections.
Well, you know, John, this is something that economists, certainly environmental economists, have been talking about for a while. As you start to see more drought, more extreme weather, more extreme heat, floods, that plays into supply chains, it raises commodity prices, it basically increases unpredictability and volatility, all of which are sort of fundamental problems for global businesses that depend on global supply chains. And, you know, we're starting to see global corporations that, you know, aren't necessarily green-minded, but they are experiencing disruptions to their supply chains, spiking prices, volatility, instability as a result of the changing weather.
And some of the countermeasures to prepare for weather instability aren't necessarily green themselves. I suspect to deal with supply chain disruptions, you have to develop greater redundancy, which may mean greater numbers of vehicles burning more fossil fuels to sort of be at the ready so that your disruption can be minimized.
So corporations are doing different things to deal with this. I mean, and this is a fairly new development, certainly, in the global corporate world. But Coca-Cola, the company that I reported on that I just thought was very interesting, and they have been experiencing problems with water shortages and droughts at their factories around the world. They actually lost an operating license in India as a result of a drought and water shortages. So what they're doing is using water efficiency methods. They're using conservation practices, and they're also looking at relocating some of their plants. And in the long term, they're just incorporating these threats into their long-term corporate strategy, their long-term corporate planning. The other thing they're doing, though, is backing policies, you know, backing policies and politicians who are willing to address climate change.
So we are reaching a tipping point where efforts made to minimize the impact on the bottom line is also becoming a possible consensus to develop broader mitigation strategies to actually reverse certain trends that might help some of these businesses. Is that what you're saying?
Well, at this point, I think scientists will tell you there's not much that can be done in the way of reversing the impacts of climate change. It's keeping it from getting worse. But when you get big corporations acting on policy because they're concerned about their bottom lines, that tends to have an impact on the policy and political process. It's worth noting, if you have companies like Coke and Nike looking at where they're going to give their political contributions or what kinds of policy, both in the U.S. and abroad, they're going to push governments for, those are voices that have power and are listened to.
What about the other Coke, the Coke brothers of Coke Industries? Any chance they're going to show up at Davos today to talk about climate change?
So the Coke brothers, they have their own annual summit, some kind of power summit. You know, they are loud and clear on the record as opposing climate policy, opposing a price on carbon, questioning the science of climate change. But lining up on the other side, you have a lot of corporations who say, we don't care about ideology, we care about our bottom line. And the bottom line is that this is having an impact on our profits. And, you know, we're interested in stopping a problem that's disrupting our supply chains. So it's interesting to see you're starting to see corporations saying, you know, we're motivated by the bottom line. We're motivated by needing to make long-term corporate strategic plans. This is a practical thing for us to do.
Well, so far, no sign that there's a drought in the money the Koch brothers are willing to spend on fighting climate change policy. But at this point, the divisions in the corporate world are pretty interesting. Coral Davenport, thanks so much.
Thank you. Always great to be with you.
Coral Davenport is energy and environment reporter for our partner, The New York Times. What is that tune? It's a standard, but not a jazz standard. It's certainly a classic, but not classical. You can stop screaming now. Most people who have ever played a video game recognize that immediately as the soundtrack of your adventures inside the Mushroom Kingdom. Mario and Luigi taking on Bowser, escaping down the green pipes on their way to rescuing Princess Peach. Video game music, and that from Super Mario Brothers, is increasingly being acknowledged as a rich, young genre, hybrid film music and dance music with some new twists. A movie scene stays the same, but game music has to work however a scene turns out. And at the first North American conference this week of ludomusicologists, it's such a new name they still don't know if they want to use it, conferees gathered with an excitement they say comes from watching the birth of a brand new art form. Stephen Rialli is an assistant professor of music at Youngstown State University, and he helped organize this first-of-its-kind conference.
The most interesting thing about video game music is the sense in which it is typically interactive. So if you think of a common film score, you can always expect the movie to be the same every time you watch it. So if you're writing music for a film, the music is going to be the same every time you watch it. Whereas if you're playing a game and you have decisions to make and choices to make, then composers has a challenge, which is to make sure that the score that he or she composes is going to be able to sync up with indeterminate actions on your part.
So that means, the score is not a piece of music like you would normally think about it. It's actually a kind of modular set of units that have to be able to fit together in an infinite number of ways.
In many cases, that's absolutely correct. And we discussed over the weekend different approaches to this, how you might be able to put those modules together, or how you might create a video game that actually chafes against the modular nature of its score.
Well, let's get some examples. What's an example of a score that works really well in this kind of infinite harmony sort of setup?
Well, I looked at a game called Dyad recently. And in this particular game, each action that the player does is associated with a particular kind of musical cue. And the levels are entirely randomly generated so that each time you play through it, you're going to have a different musical score come out of it. It would actually be impossible to produce the same piece of music twice.
And is the idea here not to make the game feel old to the user on some level?
I think in that case, it's to really experiment with the nature of interactivity and how that can produce a score. This is actually a pretty old idea. In the 1950s, for example, John Cage was working with scores that were modular and experimental and would change every time. So this isn't exactly a brand new feature of video games. In fact, you can even look back at Mozart, who composed a composition that would work out, you roll a die, that selects what measure you're going to play, and then that sequence puts together some composition that will be the same every time.
Is there something about a video game theme that, while interacting with the play of a game, makes it more memorable, sort of brands it into your brain in a different kind of way? And how do you come up with a theme without really distracting from the game itself?
There are different aspects. Some games actually want the music to argue against what you're playing with. So I wrote about a piece called a game called Katamari Damacy. Where the different musics in this game transform an original theme, and at one level actually transform it in a way that distracts the player and kind of makes the level a little bit more difficult to complete.
So in some ways, the shooting games, the popular games like Call of Duty or something, are really much more like traditional film scores in that they're just supplementing action that's taking place and are very, very much below the radar in terms of the gamer.
Well, I think that what you're talking about is genre, and you can compare the genre of games to things like genres in film or genres in music. So you have your big studio and your summer blockbuster hits that are huge productions with major set pieces and that are supposed to bedazzle the viewer. And then you've got small indie outlets making low-budget films that are supposed to be appealing to a much more artistic set. So I think you've got the same kind of spectrum in video gaming as you do in film or music or any of the other arts.
So in terms of the future of musicians, you or some of your students might want to move into this area and actually do composition?
Yeah, you bet. In fact, I already do have a student who's making music in video games. He has a game that is either already out or is going to be coming out soon on the Wii U that he wrote the score for. So actually, I think if you talk to a lot of people, maybe in their teens and 20s, being able to write music for a video game could be the one thing that they want to do.
And thinking back on your sort of video game life, are there themes that stand out to you just purely as pop tunes, as hits?
Yeah, on my playlist, I do have a few video game soundtracks that I just like to listen to by themselves. So the soundtrack to Rayman Origins is fantastic. Super Mario Galaxy is fantastic. These are just great pieces of music.
And you literally just put them on and walk around?
Yeah.
That's terrific. What do you think this does to the whole idea of, you know, musicology? Is this genre becoming mature enough to be like the emergence of other genres in Mozart's time, in Beethoven's time?
Well, I think the fact that we can have a conference like this and get media attention for an academic conference, which is pretty much unheard of, tells us that there is something here and that there's a market for this, there's a demand for this, and that ultimately video games are going to be taken seriously. I think about the nature of film in the early part of the 20th century, which was just treated as something of a technological trifle. It's interesting, but it will never be true art. 100 years later, it's really hard for us to imagine that anybody thought film would never be art. And I think the same is happening with video games. When Roger Ebert spoke on video games back in 2005, he said they will never be art. They will never be able to be artistic elements in the way that film is, for example. So it's really ironic because 100 years before, you had theorists making the same claims about film.
Stephen Reale is assistant professor of music at Youngstown State University and the lead organizer of the North American Conference on Video Game Music. Thanks, Stephen.
Thanks so much.
So to end this hour this week, you're born, you open your eyes, you figure out what you love, and then you go for it, right? A rich, full life driven by passion and bliss. How's that going for you? Of course, if that was really the way it worked, we would all be living with our mothers today, right? And making a career out of watching brightly colored mobiles above our beds.
You've got to find what you love, and that is as true for work as it is for your lovers. Your work is going to fill a large part of your life. And the only way to be truly satisfied is to do what you believe is great work. And the only way to do great work is to love what you do. If you haven't found it yet, keep looking and don't settle.
Thank you, Steve Jobs. Hey, you over there at Walmart, Steve Jobs thinks you settled. Bus driver on 3rd Avenue, settled. Postal employee, well, maybe not a lot of interest in what Steve Jobs has to say over there, but then what do I know? Fortunately, you gave us some great insights here about how it's often a journey to love, not a journey from what you love to some perfect gig. Norwell, Massachusetts. I volunteered at my daughter's school library, loved it, and took a master's degree to do it professionally. I began as a molecular geneticist. That's great. Flint, Michigan. Trying to find the work you love is a first world problem that most of the world doesn't even consider any more than being able to fly. In a sense, it diminishes the value of work, so only do it if you love it. Portland, Oregon. I have my dream job. I'm the executive director of a nonprofit social service agency that helps homeless families with children. San Antonio, Texas. This is my favorite. I work as a pest control technician in San Antonio. Growing up, I never thought I'd be doing this. Every day I go to work, I like my job a little more each time. It's never the same. I believe one day I'll come to love it. Norm Stokulski in Detroit. I'm doing what I love. I started from ground floor. I'm a school board member. Started out cleaning toilets at the schools. It took years of learning how a district works. Are you doing what you love? Mia Tokamitsu holds a Ph.D. in art history. Her recent essay, published in Jacobin magazine, In the Name of Love, is a critique of the do-what-you-love commandment. Mia, welcome to The Takeaway.
Hi, it's good to be here.
So let me just ask you right off the bat, who gets to follow what it is they love, to do what they love? Is it uniform in society? Does everyone really have that option?
Well, the popular mythology certainly is that anyone can do what they love. And to reinforce this myth, we look to exceptional class-transcending icons like Oprah Winfrey and Bill Clinton. The idea is that all it takes is enough hard work and passion, and anyone can succeed in a career that they find emotionally rewarding and succeed fantastically. But the reality remains that the people who get to do what they love are mostly those with the financial capital to acquire credentials required by many of these prestigious and personally rewarding jobs. Not just degrees, but also things like unpaid internships, rent in expensive cities where many of these jobs are located, etc. The superficial uplift of do what you love is really effective at masking the social mechanisms that determine who gets to do what kind of work.
And of course, you've come to this premise because you're a bitter young person who's been whacked in the head with the shovel of reality and been prevented from doing what it is you love, right?
No, not at all. I greatly enjoy doing my work as an art historian, but I think that it can be dangerous in any field where it's very easy to overly identify with your work and to forget that what you're doing is work. What happens when you over-identify with your work often is that frustrations at work or a bad day at work can never be just that. It becomes a kind of existential anxiety that lives with you after the work is over. So you can't just say, oh, that was a crummy day of research. There's this question afterwards, am I really an ethnomusicologist? Am I really living out my destiny? And that can be very oppressive.
Yeah, I mean, you shouldn't have to answer a question whether you're living out your destiny, you know, after every lunch break, it seems to me.
Certainly.
I would go along with you there. You know, the words in the sentence are a little tricky. I mean, you know, do what you love, all right?
Mm-hmm.
Now, the Oprahs of the world say love is the key word, right? But if you listen carefully, it seems more like you is the key word. It's all about you, 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 you. And then you've raised the question in that answer, do what you love, as though the only thing that you should love is like your work, your career, when in fact, people love all sorts of things that they don't, you know, pay the bills with.
Exactly. So to your first point, I think it's really important to resist the inwardness of do what you love. You know, by keeping us focused on our personal happiness, it makes it very easy to ignore the working conditions of people who aren't in our direct work orbit. And that's quite dangerous. And also, yeah, the exhortation in do what you love makes it seem like work is a very important, if not primary, source of love. And that if you aren't deriving pleasure from your work, that there's something wrong with you or something wrong with the choices that you've made in your life. And I absolutely reject that. There are so many people right now, especially in this tough job market, who are doing work that they never planned on doing and certainly never dreamed of doing, but they're doing what they need to do to get by. And I think that is just as valuable as any work could possibly be.
Does do what you love make being responsible to your family and the people that you're obligated to a dirty word?
I think it can be. You know, some of the people who've responded to me have said that on occasion, do what you love can almost be used as a bullying tactic. You know, when they don't want to work 20 hours of overtime for free, their motives and even their good faith in their work comes under question sometimes. And I think what Do What You Love does is it makes it very easy to blur the border between when you're working and when you're not working. And love also blurs the line between where we really get satisfaction in life and where we should get satisfaction.
So let me just ask you before we go. Mm-hmm. I mean, what do you really love to do? I mean, the fun, like the total smile on your face. This is what I love doing.
It's not particularly surprising answer, but I actually love being with my family, my husband and my son. That's the high point of my day. And while I very much enjoy and draw great satisfaction from my work, it just does not compare to that.
And no one should view that as a compromise.
Exactly. So that's the point I want to make. What I don't want people to do is to hate their jobs. I never advocate that. But if you acknowledge when you're working, then it's much easier to draw limits around your work and to make time in the rest of your life for the other things that you really enjoy, whether it's being with your family or whether it's spending time on your own in the garden or cooking or taking walks, whatever you need to do to find balance and pleasure in your day. It doesn't all need to come from your work.
Mia, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you very much.
Mia Tokomitsu holds a PhD in art history, is the author of an essay published in Jacobin magazine, In the Name of Love.
Hey, this is Eric from New York. I absolutely love what I do. I'm a freelance cameraman, and it's a job that I always wanted. My previous work was in public education, and I was downsized because of cuts. So instead of recycling myself back into the system, I decided to take a leap. I took small roles in production, and before you know it, I had a pretty good name in the New York City production community. Thanks.
So hire Derek for your film out there. What is it you love doing? How did you get there? Tell us your story at 877-8-MY-TAKE or visit us at thetakeaway.org. While you're there, be sure to share your soup or bowl recipes with us, a soup or a meal that you can eat in a bowl. It's our Super Bowl contest. No dips here, people. We want recipes for real food in honor of the fans who will be sitting in the cold MetLife Stadium in New Jersey in just over a week. Deadline is today. You can always do that at thetakeaway.org. And whistle a video game theme for us, won't you? Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia, and the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.